This is continuing the interview with Plato Malazimov on May 5th, 1988. You'll have to repeat just a little bit there. Bob Koenig was from Cerro de Pasco, and he had a long friendship with Newmont.
So he came to Newmont and wondered whether we'd be interested in this kind of a venture. I thought it was an interesting basic concept, departing from the usual practices, and it was worthwhile looking into this.
This is also getting into a different field, as you mentioned.
Yes. In effect, diversifying our activities. Well, the Swiss engineer had already investigated the area, various areas where navigable rivers course through the land, where there might be limestone deposits, and he found one just south of Albany, and next to a little town called Ravenna, with very large limestone deposit, and the Hudson River being navigable right up to that point. The joint venture between Cerro and Newmont provided the money for him to drill out this deposit, and indeed it was a very large deposit, and further planning, engineering planning of how the plant would be constructed and the cost of it. In the end, the total figure that he came up with, that he could build a plant of about 10 million barrel capacity a year for $64 million, using that, which was at that time probably the most modern technology that was available, and among also using very, very large equipment in order to, for example, for this very large plant, which is at that time was going to be the largest plant in the United States. He would use only two kilns, and these kilns were the largest cement kilns that that had been used in America. One of the elements that became obvious to us to investigate was the market for cement and what the price trends have been in order to determine what the viability, the economic viability of the plant. So, not being knowledgeable about cement, we had to we hired two different consultants, one very well-known consultant in New York, another one down one of the southern states, and posed the question to them to examine the report on not only on the past prices, but the, what they would see in the area that we were going to be able to penetrate, what the competition was, and what was the chances for being able to penetrate those markets with this new concept, and what the price future is likely to be for cement in the forward 10, 15 years. We also took care to have these two firms work independently of each other without the knowledge that one was doing the work. And I think we achieved that.
Wise idea.
They didn't realize that, you know, that there was another firm making the same kind of analysis. Interestingly enough, they came up with exactly the same conclusions. And up to that time, the historic trend of prices has been generally upward. And they came to the conclusion that it would continue to be upward from their own line. I won't go into the details, but they did go into great detail. It was very well reasoned and comprehensive report, and they thought that we could, with this new concept, penetrate some of the markets, coastal markets, largely because the cement plants that were located, because of the availability of limestone deposits, were mostly inland, and as they marketed their cement, they got in some cases beyond their 150-200 mile radius, and therefore gave us the opportunity of supplying cement at a lower cost in the immediate coastal areas, and then depending on transportation and the ability and our costs, we could penetrate some of their markets also. And as a result, they agreed that we really opened up the markets along the entire eastern coast and could even go into Tampa, Florida, which was on the west coast of Florida.
What sort of opposition did you have in the industry? There must have been some consternation.
That's part of the story later on.
Okay.
At any rate, all of this seemed very favorable, and we recommended to go ahead. Fred Searles took a stand against it right from the start, essentially because of his somewhat limited, but local knowledge in New Jersey and New York, where it was evident that the cement and the ready mix, which is cement mixed already with gravel so as to be able to be poured as concrete, business was in the hands of mostly Italians and Irishmen and people that manipulated politicians in their own favor with bribes and so on. So he felt it was a dirty business not to get into.
Well, there's been talk of a mafia connection.
And mafia connection also. So that this was his main reason. Well, we knew that, of course, and however, it wasn't. This was not the characteristic of cement business throughout the area. It was, to some extent, in New York, not entirely in their hands, but largely in their hands. And we, built a distribution station here, we did not count on that as being the critical area anyway. So, with his opposition, we went ahead with this plant and proceeded with the construction of the plant. Well, it soon became evident to the Swiss engineer that he could not complete it at $64 million. Part of it because of not too accurate an estimate as to how much it would cost, and part of it because of inflation and so on. However, he was so determined to justify himself and maintain his reputation that he started modifying the plant in order to be able to meet the $64 million figure. So he cut here and he cut there and he cut everywhere. At any rate, the result of it was that the plant was really not a 10 million barrel plant, but it was about a 7.5 or 8 million dollar plant. And he cut many corners, and the plant was not quite as good a plant as we hoped it might be. The result of it was that when they started operations, they had all kinds of problems and troubles, technical troubles with the plant. One of the most critical ones was these very large kilns, which because of their length and because the support were so far apart, began to sag in the middle, and the sagging process dislodged the brick inside, and they had to be rebricked too often and all that. Anyway, this is only one of the troubles. I won't attempt to relate all the others. We did have problems with also with very large motors that we used in the grinding mills, and those were essentially the fault of the manufacturer, actually. And they had to be replaced. At any rate, it cost us a lot of money to try to put this plant in shape, which was finally done. Then the most critical part of it was the marketplace. Instead of the market price going up, the market price froze and then started going down, actually. And the reason for it was essentially that besides us, there were other plants, cement plants built, and all of a sudden there was an overcapacity in the market. And everybody competed with each other, and the only way, and they were so independent, there was no statesman-like attitude on the part of cement companies saying that, well, gee, we're destroying the price, maybe I should curtail, if I curtail, somebody else will curtail and we'll get this. As the steel company does, as the automobile company does, and they do that without getting involved into antitrust voluntarily. Cement industry never was able to do this, and they just undercut each other, and as a result, the price almost collapsed. Well, the result on that Atlantic Cement was disastrous, of course. Year after year, we would lose money, but one thing give credit to the organization original, that we never had the problem of selling all the cement that we produced. Mm. And we were not the prime cost cutters. We all suspected they might be doing that, but they were just following the price that they could, so somebody else had cut, but they were not the price cutters. Of course, the other cement companies always accused us, and they were, when you were asking what did the others think about it, that was the problem. While we were constructing this and knowing of this very huge plant coming in and invading their territory, they got terribly concerned about this, and of course they were upset over this, and they probably started cutting even before the actual actual surplus emerged. Well, while we had a lot of trouble in turning this plant profitable, finally did get become profitable, but we had to put a lot of money into this. Into this venture beyond the $64 million. By 1985-86, it became plain that not only because of constant and persistent overcapacity domestically, there was also an invasion of foreign interest into cement industry, and they took up, bought some companies, American companies, and also there was increasing imports of cement into the United States, which further created problems.
Where was it imported from?
The imports came from, some from Mexico, some from Venezuela, from Greece, from Sweden, from Spain, even some from France. But Spanish were the first ones to invade this market in quantity, and Greece was probably Greeks were the last. Some Scandinavian cement came in at the same time, and some of the Caribbean producers also came in with lower cost cement.
And what foreign companies were investing? Where was the foreign money coming from?
Well, those were existing companies in Europe who were furnishing the European market. And then they expanded to bring the cement here.
You said also, I was going back to a previous statement that you made. You said
several foreign companies came in here. I can enumerate them, but I just don't remember them offhand.
Was it Arabian money?
No. Actually, a French company came in and a German company. And then bought the American and a Swedish company.
I see.
And lately, and also an English company, Blue Circle Cement. Well, we had, I think it was the third manager in the plant by the name of Jack Gordon, who was very knowledgeable about marketing, good cement man, but he's had a lot of experience also in the aggregate business. And, he was essentially realistically minded, and it was just before he came that we started try to improve the cost part of the picture of cement by entered into a venture involved an agreement with better steel companies that their steel company works in at Sparrows Point. The scheme was to utilize the slag that was produced by their blast furnaces in making cement, special cement, slag cement, which has qualities very similar to cement and in some cases even superior, but is not used to very much a very great extent in this country, even though in Europe and in South Africa this is an accepted cement product and utilized extensively.
Slag cement.
Slag cement. Cement made out of slag. The slag produced by blast furnaces has all the properties that the slag that the cement has in making cement out of shale and limestone, and all you have to do with slag is to crush it, grind it fine enough, and that's the final cement. So that becomes a raw material in effect, what you have is a product that has already been through a kiln. In effect, it's not a kiln, but it's been in a blast furnace. So it's already, the composition of the cement is already made in the blast furnace, and all you have to do is then to reduce it to the fine size that's customary in cement industry. Anyway, this was carefully researched and agreement made with Bethlehem, and the plant was built and is operating successfully. And Jack Gordon implemented finally the final construction of this and the marketing of it also. However, he became apprehensive about the cement business as a whole on the, in the East because of the impact of the imported cement, which he could see was growing all the time and against which you couldn't really fight in any way because it came in at usually at a lower price, could come at a lower price than even American cement, so that they would be able to penetrate the certainly the coastal markets, cement, which were the same markets that Atlantic cement had. So his opinion finally expressed to me was that we might have good years, but we will also have bad years. And we, it's Atlantic cement is probably on the long run and on the average is not going to be a very attractive venture. And we were then thinking about selling it anyway because our principal shareholder didn't think the cement business was a good business for us to be in. They wanted us to get rid of it. At any rate, Jack Gordon made contact with a Norwegian company, and then the English company, Blue Circle, became interested. And as a result of negotiation, which didn't last very long, we finally sold the cement company for $171 million, which included certain advances that Newmont made in developing this slag cement project. And this represented about a $7 million profit of what we put into a business, not including, however, some $28 million of dividends that we have received. So we haven't lost any money in it, but obviously the amount of money we put in it, the return was not very favorable. That's it. We can go to lunch now. As an example of diversification, I became interested in acquiring an interest in Foot Mineral Company, which had a lithium deposit in King Mountain, South Carolina, and in effect shared the United States market with Lithium Corporation of America, the two companies being the only viable producers of lithium in North America.
Is lithium a metal? Is it considered a metal?
Lithium is a metal, yes. Uh-huh.
But non-ferrous?
It's non-ferrous metal.
Okay.
Foot Mineral was a company that was known to me for some time through my acquaintance, becoming acquainted with Gordon Chambers, who at one time was chief executive officer of Foote. He had come into Newmont a number of times in the early years with propositions for us to share or perhaps buy some of the ventures that they started. The one that I remember particularly was in Brazil. And when he began to explain it to me, it didn't seem very attractive to me, and apparently he read my mind, and towards the end of our conversation says, well, I really don't think it's all that attractive to you. It's all that attractive, and you probably don't want to do anything about this. Well, I was surprised and at the honesty of this man, and I immediately had much respect for him, which I maintained through the years. And later on, I invited him to become a member of the board of Newmont. Through him, I got to know something about Foote and their operations, and their operations in lithium interested me essentially because of the long-term promise of lithium. This is a very unique metal with unique electrical properties and also unique chemical properties. And I felt that these would be in time recognized, and lithium producer could have an interesting future. In the early 60s, Newmont acquired, at my initiative, some 19.5% interest in the company by buying stock on the open market. Later, we increased this percentage to 32.8%. However, in the meantime, I called up the then chief executive, who was Anthony Bliss, to become acquainted with him. I did not disclose at that time that we had an interest in Foote, and because of my acquaintance with Chambers, this was a natural kind of a contact to have made. His headquarters were in Pennsylvania, and we chatted about this and that, and I talked about the business, on which he was rather reserved in answering my questions. And towards the end of the conversation, I said, well, maybe there is some opportunity for us to do something together in this, perhaps, because I think that perhaps Newmont might be interested in acquiring an interest in your company. Well, his reaction to this was very cool, and obviously he didn't like this, and the conversation ended in no encouragement on his side to proceed with this. In spite of that, we proceeded to buy some more shares, and we got 32.8% interest in the company. We thought that perhaps that's all that we needed to have, and we'd have sufficient interest to take advantage of such growth that the company might have in the future. At one point, I got a call from Anthony Bliss, and he says, remember that telephone call together and your interest in the company? Well, I have a problem right now that I'd like to talk to you about. Could I come and see you? And he did, and the problem was that another company called Vanadium Corporation of America decided to acquire or raid the company and acquire the whole of the company. He was not, Bliss was not sympathetic to that, and he said that, but I'd rather be acquired by you than I would be by VCA, and are you still interested in our company? So I said yes, I was, and we discussed the matter of the VCA interest and concluded that perhaps he and I should see the VCA people and discuss the matter and see what possibility there was of diffusing VCA's interest in Foot. So we arranged a meeting with a man who was the head of international mining, of whom I knew something, and he had made an investment in VCA and became
International Mining Company.
Yes, and he became the principal shareholder of VCA, and it was he who conceived the idea that they should either merge or acquire Foot Mineral Company. Well, these original conversations led to nothing, but we had several more conversations, and little by little it became apparent that there was not much point in fighting this. In the open market, we just raised the value of the stock, and it became apparent to him. And then he proposed, well, what about somehow merging the company together? And then we talked about management and who would be the manager of this company. And he ended up by saying, well, I'd be satisfied if this was managed by the existing manager of the company, and you would have a principal role in it. So we proceeded to try to work out a merger agreement, which we did. VCA was a company well known to most every mining company. They had at one time a very good high-grade vanadium deposit in Peru, which by this time had been mined out pretty much, but they were still in the vanadium business. And they also diversified little by little over the years into certain ferrous metals like chromium and titanium and other products. Most of these had to be treated in electrical furnaces, and they had a number of centers where this was being done. The company never grew to be a very large company. It was a comparatively small company, but it was a profitable company and competed pretty well with the giants in the business like Union Carbide.
Okay, let's stop. All right.
At any rate, the merger was made on estimates essentially made by the VCA of how attractive their business was. Well, it turned out that their estimates were not very good, and actually the ferrous business, instead of being as attractive as thought, kept on going downhill. And the Foot Mineral Company, as a result, became unprofitable when it was profitable as a lithium company. Actually, the lithium part of their business was always profitable. And non-ferrous, the ferrous metal business, which was now became a larger part of the combined company's business, was unprofitable, so that the net result was lack of profits. This was a disappointing development, and we felt in the company that something should be done with it, and we studied the company to try to see what we could do, and it appeared to us finally that they should get rid of their ferrous metal business, in effect disinvest of the merger that we had made with BCA. Just about that time, Anthony Bliss died, and he was, and I had a, as a part of the director and major shareholder, we had to find a replacement for him, and because it was a very specialized company with important research facilities, and the specialization of their operations was a little foreign to what we knew in Newmont, I felt that the successor should be somebody from Footman & Company, and we actually finally decided on his chief chemist and research engineer, and he became the chief executive.
Should we give his name?
Oh. It escapes me right now.
All right.
I'll get it.
Can be found easily.
He was not a good businessman, but a very good research man, very nice person, intelligent person. But somehow we couldn't get the company going under his stewardship either. And later on, he retired. He took early retirement, and we elected this as his successor, a younger man who became the president. But with him, we have the same problem. I think that the main problem with both of them were that they were not the entrepreneurial type. They were very good, honest people, hardworking, understood the business well, understood the marketing well, but somehow I couldn't get them energized to think in terms of expanding the operation, shrinking the unprofitable part of the business, even though they agreed with me and they tried to do it, but somehow they never were able to effect this. And the sale of some of the non-ferrous metal business eventually took place, not at very good, on very good terms, but only partially. So the company was always plagued with the ferrous business being unprofitable. In the course of re-examination of what to do with this company, in 1974, when on my recommendation, Jack Thompson became the president of the company, he proposed as a remedy to our frustrations with this company, acquiring control, complete control of the company instead of the 32.8% of it. And it meant going into the market again and offering a price above the market in order to acquire this control. I was not very sympathetic to that, and some of my associates like Roy Bonebreak weren't either. And I had a problem in that I had just recommended Jack to become the president, and the first initiative that he has shown was to acquire the control of this company.
This is president of Newmont.
Of Newmont Mining Company. And it seemed to me it would be questionable for me to say no to this proposal, as when it was the first one that he had by himself proposed to us to do, even though I thought probably was erroneous. So I thought that, well, okay, we'll do this. This isn't going to be too expensive, and maybe it's going to be an error, but I guess people learn from errors, and I will let him go ahead and do it. And I was never enthusiastic about the move. So we went ahead and we acquired 90.6% of the company at some cost to us, of course. Well, the acquiring control of the company caused us to be the dominant shareholder, and therefore the management had to listen to what we wanted, and we had the right to say what they should do or they should not do. But somehow we never could find a way, even with this control, of turning this company around. And I tried in every way to see if we misunderstood the company and to get a better understanding. And among others, I sent people out to the operations and to report to me what they found, what weaknesses there are, and what we should be doing. Among the people that I sent was Oscar Tangle, in whose judgment I had great confidence. But none of these efforts succeeded in presenting some kind of a plan to turn this company around into a profitable venture. Sometime before that, Robert Koenig retired from Cerro de Pasco, and I invited him to be a director of Foot Mineral Company. And Bob, knowing South America very well, knew of a lithium property that Anaconda had in Salar de Atacama, which is a desert area where Chuquicamata is operating, but considerably north of that, where there's a very large dry salt lake that was known to have lithium in it. He called this to the attention of Foote, and Foote knew about this but never did anything about it. And with his urging, we proceeded to try to acquire this. Just about this time, or shortly before that, we hired a new vice president, a new man by name of Phil C. Walsh. From W.R. Grace Company, he was a close friend and associate of John C. Duncan, whom I consulted to find out the qualities of Walsh. He was a charming Irishman and quite able negotiator with some background in mining, but not actual experience in mining. But I found him quite useful in utilizing him in negotiation, especially in South America, because he was quite fluent in Spanish, having spent some time in Peru and Chile. So he was my principal negotiator with the government that had the Salar de Atacama, took it over from Anaconda after they nationalized Anaconda's interests in Chile. And this was a long, tortuous, very difficult negotiation, and I must say that he performed remarkably well, very diplomatic. He never got out of my control, so that he and I would discuss the terms, and the terms had constantly to be changed under pressure of demands from the government and so on. But he never, as I had experienced before with negotiators, would all of a sudden find some personal initiative to go ahead and do it, and then I'd find about it when it was too late, if it was erroneous. But Phil was remarkable that way, that while he was the only negotiator, I didn't personally negotiate any part of this face-to-face with government officials, and was Phil who, to whom I gave the authority, but he never misused that authority. We always kept within the frame of what I conceived to be a good agreement. Well, after some 3 years of effort and all sorts of changes in the government in the meantime, changes of the negotiating parties, we finally reached an agreement. And it was the first agreement in Chile after nationalization of the American interests that permitted a foreign company to have more than 50% interest. I insisted on that we would have 55% interest, and they finally yielded to this. And the 45% interest was a Chilean company called Corfo, C-O-R-F-O. Then we proceeded to examine the deposit, drill it out, and evaluate it, and indeed we found that this was a fantastic lithium deposit. Today it's the greatest lithium deposit in the world, actually. One of the problems that we had with it after, actually we had an agreement first to be able to evaluate it and then made the final agreement afterwards. But the discussion in the final terms led to the Chileans encroach on, we wanted the entire dry lake, and they kept on encroaching and reducing the area that we could, that would give us, finally gave us a limited area of about a third of the total lake, but fortunately it was the highest grade part. We knew that, they knew it also, and they permitted. But one of the great problems that we had in negotiation is that lithium is something that can be used in atomic energy. And there is a possibility, theoretical possibility, that lithium can be the metal rather than uranium in having nuclear bombs. The military and Chile were aware of that. They felt that this was something that they could dominate Latin America with when it would be developed and so on, and therefore they didn't want to give away any interest at all. So there was a conflict within the government itself in what kind of terms there would be offered. And they always wanted some kind of a control, and to be sure that we could expand and that they could use the other part of the lake and develop additional lithium, that we would not be involved in that. At any rate, this is some of the difficulties that we had encountered. But once we made the deal, I must say the Chileans kept to the terms of the deal, and we found them to be quite good partners and not difficult in on the board level. And we were able to create a management team, mostly of Chileans, but without they're interfering with our judgment as to who would be the people that would manage it. Turned out to be a very successful venture, not a terribly expensive one. I think we spent a total of $60 million, most of which was borrowed. And it took about 2 or 3 years to get it into a profitable category, but now it is profitable, and I think that last year it made something like $8 million for first profits. This, however, was not enough to turn the overall profits, because the ferrous business kept on deteriorating and creating even more losses. Eventually, shortly after I retired, within a year, Newmont sold their interest for something like $70 million. I advised against this because I felt that what they should do is sell the unprofitable business and keep the lithium, because here was absolutely unique deposit. I don't think anybody could probably find another to replace it. We were giving it up forever, you might say. And it's true, it wasn't all that profitable then, but if the future, which did not develop as fast as we expected it to, but still, there's no denying that that lithium is a unique and a very exceptional metal, and they keep on finding, I mean, the uses of it keep on increasing, and therefore, I still think it has a great future.
Who bought it?
The Cyprus Minerals Company bought it. My good friend John C. Duncan, now is as a chairman, is involved in the ownership of this and the development of this wonderful deposit. And Walsh, who was our vice president, left us to join St. Joe for a while, to join his friend Duncan. And then when St. Joe was acquired by Fluor Corporation, he became a director also of Fluor, just as John Duncan was. And now that Fluor Corporation has been getting rid of all that they acquired in St. Joe, both John Duncan and Walsh are now in Cyprus Minerals, and Jack is a president, and Walsh is a director of that company, and he remains the director of a wholly owned subsidiary now of Cyprus, in Lithium Corporation, which they value very much because his contact with Chileans has been maintained, and he's a sort of the person that keeps the stormy weather waters calm. Mm.
And where do they sell the lithium? Where do they sell the lithium?
They sell lithium in Europe through Metallgesellschaft, who has sales offices there, and sell other parts of lithium that is not contracted by Metallgesellschaft here in the United States through their own sales organization. I omitted to say that there was an instance while we were trying to restructure the company and sell its ferrous metal products, where a Swedish company became interested in this, and we had a final meeting with the Swedes in my office when roughly the terms of the acquisition of the ferrous metal companies were more or less defined by the Foot management, and they came the final meeting was to secure my approval of this. And one part of the ferrous metal business that was always profitable up to that time was the vanadium part, partly due to the fact that they were getting vanadium very cheaply from Highveld. And because it was a profitable one, I felt that we should not sell it, since it was that was profitable and lithium was profitable. Everything else was unprofitable. So I refused to have the vanadium be part of what the Swedes were buying. But Swedes wanted that so badly that the whole deal was upset because of my reservation. So it was my fault that we didn't sell the ferrous metal company that early, and this was way back in about 10 years ago.
What was the Swedish company?
SKF.
Which is
essentially... Yeah, and I think that their price was about $66 million, so that, which was a pretty good price, since the whole company with the lithium went for $90 million. We had 90% of it, so that's why $74 million was Newmont's share. So it was a real mistake. We should have done that. Actually, the vanadium business within 2 or 3 years turned unprofitable also.
SKF essentially is a government.
No, it's a private company.
Isn't
it? I think it's a private company.
Oh, well, I thought that was the National Mining.
No.
No?
It's essentially a manufacturing company, but they need the... they wanted to diversify and go into the American markets as well. And this would be, this was a method of doing so.
Mm-hmm.
The next one I'd like to discuss is Bethlehem, briefly. I knew of Bethlehem Copper Company, which was a British Columbia company and owned by Canadians, again from my friend Clem Pollock of American Smelting and Refining Company. At one time, American Smelting was interested in this company, and they thought of acquiring controlling interest, and later on they had a change in management and decided not to do it and dropped the whole idea. And I knew something about this, so in my effort towards diversify and growth, I thought that that was worth looking at again, and we made contact with the company and learned that 22.5% of it was owned by a Japanese company, the Sumitomo Metal Mining Company. The company was the Bethlehem.
Is this connected with Bethlehem Steel?
No. This is Bethlehem Copper Company. This
okay.
has nothing to do with
right.
Bethlehem Steel. The company wasn't doing very well. Sometimes profitable, sometimes not profitable. And apparently Sumitomo, to whom they sold copper concentrates they produced from their mine, became sort of disenchanted with their interest and was willing to sell the interest. And we bought their interest for $26.6 million. Got on the board and at the same time, another company, an American company, run by Robert Allen, called Texas. It was a sulfur company actually, called something like Texas Sulfur Company. I'll get the proper name.
Gulf Sulfur.
That's it. Gulf Sulfur Company became interested. They acquired an interest in also, so that between Bob Allen and ourselves, we really had the major interest, and we had a virtual control of the company. The reason that I was interested in Bethlehem Copper Company was not because of their own deposit and what they were doing, but because they had 20% of the ore body, actually their claims covered 20% of the total ore body that was known as the Valley Copper Ore Body, 80% of which was owned by Cominco. And it was a very large ore body at that time, estimated to contain some 750 million tons of 0.48% copper, with very low stripping ratio. And all our estimates as to the economic attractiveness of that deposit indicated that this would be a very low-cost producer, despite the fact that the grade of the ore was that low.
Where was this?
This is in British Columbia, in the same district where Bethlehem Copper operated. There is another
very large company owned by Rio Tinto, known as the Lornex Mining Company, which also had a very large deposit, low-grade deposit, which was being operated at that time. In effect, therefore, my acquisition of Bethlehem Copper Company was essentially for the 20% interest that they owned in this huge deposit, and my hope that somehow in the future we could make some kind of a deal whereby the development of this new ore body would be done by not only Cominco but Newmont as well, and we would be willing to put money up, we'd work out some kind of a partnership deal. Well, we introduced that idea fairly early in the game. They didn't want to even listen to it. And we kept on going back to Cominco, talking about it, and still had no indication of no interest. I finally decided that perhaps we were talking to the wrong people, and Canadian Pacific Railroad Company of Canada owned, I believe it was controlling interest in Cominco. So, and the man at the head of that was Ian Sinclair, who was very well known as one of the leading industrial executives in Canada and very well regarded by the Canadian banks and other industrial leaders. My final check on him was through David Rockefeller, whom I knew personally quite well, and David gave me a very, very high opinion of Sinclair as being an understanding person and one that would listen and had fine judgment, great judgment, and that I told him what the problem was, that I wasn't able to get anywhere with Cominco, and did he think that I might get somewhere with Ian Sinclair, and he encouraged my making contact with him, so I did. So we went over to see him, and his main offices were in Montreal, and I recounted the story about this and pointed out that I thought that this was a great ore body. Well, he recognized that. And also I said that you know something about Newmont and its capability and so on. It seems to me that we could add something to the Cominco knowledge as a mining company, because we had been involved in several open pit operations. This was an open pit, and Cominco didn't have any open pit operations. So there'd be a know-how contribution from part of Newmont besides money. At any rate, he listened quite interestingly and nodded, yes, this would be he recognized these arguments, and I thought I was getting somewhere with him, so I decided to formulate a proposal to him. And we had to clear it with our other partners in Bethlehem, among others, Bob Allen. And I decided to make this proposal together with Bob Allen after I worked out quite an intricate proposal. But I thought it was fair for everybody and attractive for Cominco as well as for us, who were shareholders of Bethlehem. So we proceeded to launch this proposal to Ian Sinclair again another meeting that we had with him in Montreal. I think that meeting lasted something like four hours, because he went into all the details, and then he wanted to think about it and talk to his people. He was